It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spatero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
We don't know anything for a fact.
Clint Walker. Except that bulldozer kills. Carl Betts. Two men dead. The survivors watch an unmanned bulldozer continue its rampage. Killdozer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spataro, that is Sean Whalen, and we are here today with Mr. Tim Elliott. Go ahead, say hello, guys.
Hello.
This is a strange one, guys, because I think I was posting random comic covers, and I think I posted Worlds Unknown number 6, and Tim commented on it, and then I said, hey, why don't we do a Killdozer episode of Is It Jaws and follow that up with a Killdozer episode of Back to the Bins, which is exactly what we're doing. I'll just throw in, I don't remember the first time I actually saw this movie. I remember either seeing or owning, I don't recall which one it was, but being very enamored with the cover of Worlds Unknown number 6. And I don't want to get too much into that because, as I said, we're going to do a Back to the Bins episode on that that's going to follow this up. But that cover kind of made me feel a connection to this story somehow. Again, I don't remember when I first saw it. It's not the same as that cover. But anyway, I saw it then, and I watched it again the first time in several years. For the purposes of talking today, and there's a lot of nostalgia that taints my view on this one, but I think we'll get into some of the details about it as we go along. How is your history with this particular TV movie?
I've never seen this before. You brought it up as something that you wanted, that you and Tim wanted to do on the show. So that was, as anything that's fun about doing this podcast is the fact that sometimes hitting that thing that you'd never seen before. It's bizarre I haven't seen this, just because of the fact I was born in 71. So, yeah, it came out in 74, but you figure with the fact that, we had here in Cleveland, we had Superhost, which was the afternoon of rerun of movies like this type. We had Big Chuck and Little John in the evenings. We had the Ghoul Show, those type of things. This is the kind of movie that would wind up on something like that, as far as, coming back around again. I don't know how I've never seen this. And especially with the fact that it had a comic tie-in, it just seems like something that it's like naturally something that I would have gravitated towards at a certain point in time. I don't know why I've never seen it. So this totally was my first exposure. I've seen it twice. I bought it. Because I didn't have it, and I was like, oh, let me just grab it. And I watched it the first time through, and then I watched it the second time through with audio commentary. And it was two historians basically relaying background stories about – it wasn't like a direct audio commentary with cast, but it's worth listening to just because it sets the stage for what TV movies were at this time. What was popular during this time, because this was one of a number of popular TV movies that were around at that time, and just how important this particular delivery vehicle was to entertainment. You know, we take it for granted nowadays with streaming services and stuff like that, that you get movies that are more geared like this. But TV, made-for-TV movies were huge. It was a critical, a very big source. So for me, this was, I walked into this one blind. I don't have a history with it other than the fact that it's going to be a fun conversation.
I'm going to throw in for anybody who's interested in seeing this, you do not have to go Sean's route. You do not have to buy this. It is actually readily available streaming on YouTube in a fairly clear version of it. So anybody who's interested in seeing it does not necessarily have to spend any money. How about you, Tim?
Like you, I can't remember when I saw it, but I saw this as a kid because I would have been 8 when it came out. And I have vivid memories of watching it with my brothers. And I don't ever remember seeing it in reruns. And I don't think it ever came out in like what we had, like the 3 o'clock movie when I was growing up, where they would do Godzilla week or they would do Disaster week or things like that. So I don't remember ever seeing it again until I ran across it on YouTube. And then later discovered that it was a theater surgeon book or short story. And I got the book and read that. And then I realized later it was a comic. I didn't know Marvel had done an adaptation of it. So I adore this movie. I thought it scared the heck out of me when I was a kid. It's still creepy to this day, even though it is made for TV. The violence is fairly high for a made for TV 74 movie. And it's got the same musician as Kolchak, the Night Stalker. So I like the music in it too.
So you know we've all mentioned TV movies. This was a TV movie. I believe this was shown on back in the day. ABC used to do the movie of the week, and then at some point, I only have a vague memory of this. I think it was Tuesday nights they had the movie of the week, and it was a TV movie pretty much all the time. I think once in a while they'd throw a theatrical film in there. But it was such a popular vehicle that I believe at some point they went to the Tuesday and Wednesday night movies of the week, rather than have, sitcoms or whatever, family entertainment going. And they had, there were just a ton of great ones. You mentioned Kolchak. There was Brian Song, which is a really, really, critically acclaimed one. The one this is probably most like is one we've covered on Back to the Bins, and that would be Steven Spielberg's version of Duel. Mm-hmm. And I think I want to get into a little comparison with that in a moment, but I think it's worth saying, there were a lot of movies that I really remember that seem to have kind of gotten forgotten over the years. But I still have a fond memory because at the point when this came out, I was about 11 years old. And, I was pretty much loving these horror movies like The Night Stalker. And then I remember one called A Short Walk to Daylight, which was people down in a subway. And then there was an earthquake and they had to find a way out. There was another one called Trapped, which was James Brolin, who gets mugged in a department store and knocked out. And when he wakes up, the store's all been closed and locked up, and they've set Dobermans free to protect the store. So he's trapped in there with these vicious dogs. There was another one called Crowhaven Farm, which was a very creepy one about the Salem witches. So there's a lot of TV movies of this era that really stand out to me and have a special place. And that's why I said this might be a little bit more nostalgia-driven than anything else for me. This is written by Theodore Sturge, and I think people of our ilk will know him most for having written Shore Leave and
Arena.
Also, an arena. Okay, did he write Amok Time?
No, that was Dorothy Fontana, DC Fontana.
Okay. But anyway, as a Star Trek, one of the Star Trek writers, he'll be most well known for that. This was written, I believe, in the 1940s or the 1950s as a novella. So it was around for quite some time at that point. And I'm going to get to my initial comparison with the movie Duel, in that in the movie Duel, the truck that is chasing Dennis Weaver feels very anthropomorphized. It feels like it has a personality. That is one of the things in this movie that I have to say I think falls a little short. The bulldozer, they don't give it enough to make it truly feel like it has a personality in my mind. It doesn't seem to have a real thought process, which I really would have appreciated more if it felt like somehow this bulldozer was scheming as opposed to just reacting. But, you know, your mileage may vary. I'm curious as to what you guys think about the actual threat of the bulldozer and how it came across.
I thought it did. I agree. They tried to do a little bit with the lights they put on top of the bulldozer. That they try to do that as a stand-in for its eyes. They tend to glow when it's on, and they have that kind of creepy buzzing, humming noise that they use when it's about. Yeah, I think part of it is it's a slow-moving thing. It doesn't, and how it. It, throughout this movie, how it kind of sneaks up on these guys, I don't know. This is a 45-ton bulldozer that's probably louder than hell, and it keeps doing the kind of serial killer teleporting. It just happens to be there, and they don't hear it approach. But, yeah, they could have done more to make it a little more, your point, more of a threat, although it is scary because there's nothing on this place that they don't have any idea heavy equipment or anything that can kind of stop it.
Right.
Yeah. But I think it kind of falls in the with like Duel, because Duel is what, 71, 72?
I don't remember the year, but probably
it's before this. Rail, it's before this. Range.
Yes.
This kind of falls in almost the Animals Gone Wild genre that's in the 70s. That a lot of that followed Jaws. So it was always either shows like movies like Grizzly or Day of the Animals, which I think is another made-for-TV movie. So it kind of falls in that.
Food of the Gods.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. I would tell you it's also closely related to The Car with James Brolin. You've seen that.
But I believe that's later than
it
this.
It is. It's 77, I think. But it's the,
and then along those same lines, this is credited for giving Stephen King the idea for his short story Trucks, which in turn, I believe, gave him the seed that he turned into the book Christine. So there is definitely something here. Yeah. There's a seed of an idea that can be played with in horror.
He also did Maximum Overdrive, which he directed,
which was also from Trucks. The story Trucks. Yeah. Actually, I believe there were two different versions of that book that were that novella that were made into big screen movies. And there was one that he did, and then I believe there was another version of it at some point.
There is another one with Timothy Busfield, I think. It's called Trucks, I think. It's not as crazy as Maximum Overdrive.
Well, Maximum Overdrive, I know we're getting off the beaten path here, but that was the studio saying, you know what, you write a good book, Steven. Why don't you direct the movie?
Yeah.
I don't know that that was a good idea.
One of the best things they did with this in order to add to the fear factor of it was the destruction of any way for them to contact the outside world and get off the island.
Yes, and that shows a little thought process on the part of the dozer, because it's the one that destroys the radio.
Yeah, and it was so that sense of claustrophobia, which is a hard thing to do in this, in the space that they were filming this and everything like that, I think added to the sense of danger of this, which, because when the bulldozer first gets infected, I admit my first viewing, I'm watching it today, right? And we're used to a certain level of special effects now. You have to get yourself back in the mindset of what special effects were like in the 70s and the fact that they had to work under a budget. And they actually talk about this on the Blu-ray on some of the commentary, the fact that, this was an era where practical effects and even trying to bring in practical effects is going to be very costly for this type of thing. I thought they did a pretty admirable job of, like, after they established that this thing's infected. You were right about the lights, kind of using it as the eyes and stuff like that. There were points in time where I'm like, maybe I should go hug a bulldozer just to make sure I'm making friends. This kind of thing happens. I thought there was a couple parts where I laughed and flat out chuckled. Like, there's one bit where it's like hiding in behind shrubbery, and they're like, you know, doing their thing, trying to make their plan, and I'm sitting here, I'm like, are they being stalked by a bulldozer? And it didn't take away from the movie at all. It was a chuckle moment. You just move along, you see it behind this brush, and it's, you know, it's clear what it's doing. And you don't, the thing that worked there for me, admittedly, was the use of sound, where they kept it like not operating and making a ton of noise. Because to the point of the conversation earlier, it's like, this is a bulldozer sneaking around up on them. I mean, it's not like it's a quiet vehicle. I did think that they did a good job of using sound to show that, well, they wouldn't have heard anything there the way that it was just sitting there. And they were being clever in their use of sound to kind of build this, because you're under some limitations. And some of that really worked in taking me into this sense of, okay, for the hour 15 I'm watching this thing, am I being pulled into this world? And there were points in time where I was. It's a combination, I think, of good filming choices and good use of trickery and the acting talent that was a part of this whole thing to make that work in a TV movie, because your expectations as far as what they're going to do with special effects and their abilities to wow you are different with a TV movie. It just, and that always was the case. You know, it's not a theatrical release. It's not going to have that kind of big budget. It was
interesting. Yeah, to take it back to the era that it came out in, at the time, apparently the effects, the practical effects and the lighting effects were praised. So for, you know, to go to that time and that era and what they had available to them for a TV movie, this was considered to be, I don't know if I want to use the word state of the art, but it was, you know, up with the modern techniques of the day. I think two of the things that I thought they did that were attempts to personalize the bulldozer, one of which worked for me and one of which, I don't know, I kind of chuckled every time they did it. The one that worked was when they would actually show the gears shifting as if hands were manipulating them, so that, you know, it was doing it itself. So it felt to me like it gave it a little bit of a presence that it, you know, that it was thinking and that it was moving. So I thought that worked a little bit for me. The other thing they did was when they talked about it, as if it was, you know, an old friend. Hey, where's the Niner? You know, and that didn't really work for me quite so much. I didn't go for that the same way. They had the part where they confronted it with another big machine. I thought that could have been milked a little bit more. I think it would have been even more effective if that had been, whatever you want to call it, a crane or whatever with like a wrecking ball on it. And they were thinking, okay, this is how we're going to take this thing out. And somehow it outthinks them and kind of outflanks it and crushes this crane. Like, that would have been something that would have really upped the stakes. It probably would have been too effective, too expensive for them to do with the, you know, the budget they had. But I think something like that would have really just upped the stakes of this thing, and it would have made for an exciting fight scene, and put fight in air quotes, I guess.
Well, that was very reminiscent of like T-Rex versus a Triceratops or something that you've seen in every dinosaur movie when it's going up against the bucket loader.
What I'm thinking of is in Jurassic Park 3, I don't remember what the breed was of the main dinosaur that was the threat to them in it, but at one point in it, he's confronting them, that particular dinosaur, and a T-Rex comes walking up, and they get into a fight, and you're thinking, okay, this is going to be a battle, and this other one, they establish that it's far more threatening than the T-Rex that we've seen in the previous two movies by just grabbing the T-Rex in short order and snapping its neck.
Pretty quick.
And I thought that's the kind of scene we could have used in this, where, like I said, there was a wrecking ball, and you're thinking, okay, this is how this movie's going to end. They're going to end up crushing it with the wrecking ball. And it just somehow, you know, maybe it somehow clips the cable that's holding the ball, and the ball just drops to the ground, and now it's useless, or you know, something along those lines, really would have just, like I said, upped the ante for me, I think, a little bit.
Probably is they. I'm sure all this equipment was rental when they were filming this.
don't damage the Niner.
Exactly. Don't damage the. And it would probably have been too expensive to do model work or something like that, because I think other than maybe some of the tent scenes, this is probably all shot on location. It was shot in a off-road park about 30 miles outside of L.A., which is a shame is now closed down. But it was apparently a popular place for Steve McQueen. They bring that up. Sean, you said you listened to the commentary. They bring that up in the commentary that it was I can't remember the name of it. But it was like it was in the zone, so it was 30 miles from L.A., so it was easy to get to. And they, you know, it's standing in for some island off Africa, I think, in the film. In the yeah. in the comic, I think it was in the Pacific Ocean somewhere, because it takes place in World War II in the comic and the book, and they're building a landing strip for the military. And this, they're building it for this whale company.
A very good right. friend of mine lives relatively close to L.A., and when I heard that in the commentary, I perked up because I'm like, oh, I'd like to go there. And then,
like, I thought the same thing.
I'm like, oh, man.
You get pictures. This is where they filmed Killdozer.
Yeah. I like that kind of stuff, though. It's something when you see a movie, sure. It's like you kind of want to go see, okay, where did they actually – and can you pick out anything that, like, you remember seeing in the film? That stuff is cool to me.
Well, that was – one thing about me moving to Vegas is that I'm 4 hours from L.A., so I can go when I can. I can go, like, I went to Zuma Beach, Paul, so I saw the cliff scene where they filmed the end of Planet of the Apes, that kind of stuff. So.
No, they filmed that on Manhattan, because the Statue of Liberty was there.
Trucked in a bunch of dirt.
Talking about the cast, it's funny, like most of the cast, except for one person, is familiar with me for like one role. There's six people in the cast. Three of them are familiar with me for one role. We have Clint Walker is the main star, so we'll talk about him first. I know him as Posey from The Dirty Dozen. That's what he stands out to me as. I mean, he's done a lot of things. He's obviously, at the time this was made, he was clearly the biggest star of the bunch. But that's, like I said, that's the role I know him best as. But I thought he did a good job in this. I thought he came across as earnest. He was somewhat two-dimensional, but I think the part was two-dimensional, not the acting. And I, you know, I thought he was a good hero. He doesn't, they don't put him in the same situations you would normally in a horror movie of this type, where it ends up, you know, he's the last man standing and, you know, how's he going to get out of this? They didn't go with all of those standard tropes. So I thought it was good that way. He is showing like leadership ability because he is the leader on the crew. I thought he played the part well. I think he was a good choice.
Yeah, I agree. He's very stoic. Maybe a little slow to come to realization that there's something weird going on, although the other actors around him are telling him, especially the actor that plays what he calls Sourball, the other guy that survives, that they're quick to, like, there's something here, and you need, you know, he's, at one point he tells him, he said, you can't just put your head in the sand. You know, there's, and he's a little, and I don't know if it's, they try to give Walker a little bit of a backstory that he is, they call him a dried out drunk, so that this is his last chance, I guess, to prove himself for this company or else he's out. So he's very determined to get the project done. They have to clear this area. So that seems to cloud his judgment at first until finally you know, but that's a typical writing of you're not going to believe something fantastic can happen until it's right in your face, even though Robert Urich tells him, you know, early on that he saw this blue light that infects the blade of the dozer.
But I think that makes total sense, really, because if this is real life, which obviously it's not, but if this is real life, you're not jumping to the conclusion that this bulldozer just came to life. You know, that's one of the last things you're going to think. You're going to think someone's messing with you. Even when all the evidence supports the fact that this thing has come to life, you're going to think, that's just too far-fetched. That can't be. So his skepticism and his being slow to come to the realization, to me, is pretty realistic.
Well, and they do set a precedent that he talks, when he's talking to the mechanic, I think his name is Chubb, says, I guess there's, I don't know if this is real or not, but I guess there is, he says, remember that the equipment we had that kind of went wild and nobody could control it? So I guess there is a history of sometimes these big construction pieces will kind of go haywire. And that's, at least that allows him to think, okay, well, that's what it is. This thing is malfunctioning, or there's some kind of a defect in it, that it's not driving on its own. So it's not like if suddenly somebody told you, Paul, oh, your car, we saw your car driving itself. You're like, that's impossible. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, I don't have a self-driving car.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about his portrayal, and especially with that character, is sometimes when they portray characters like this where they're a little bit off-putting, you know, they're a little bit distant from everybody, in order to keep viewers hooked, they'll do that, those scenes that connect you with them. So that way, you know, you're like, you understand why they have weird interactions with others, but we know the soft side of the person, you know, the pieces that the others don't. They didn't do that with him, with us. I mean, we do journey with him and we get to know him, you know, how he's affected by everything that's happened here. And I think there is a bit of an evolution of the character at the end. But what I liked about it is, first of all, it shows a need for an ensemble cast. You've got to have other people in this. If you don't have them, then what you don't want is this character that you can't connect with, who is your lead, and then you can't get anywhere. It's his interactions with these others that I think become really intriguing. But it was an interesting choice. That's one of the things that I felt was kind of fresh, because usually it's like you have this lead character who we should be rallying behind, we should want to follow, and I actually liked the fact that he wasn't your traditional heroic lead. Actually, I don't know that there really is a hero. That these are guys trying to... This is like a twisted game of Survivor, where the intriguing part is there's not really that one person you're like, that's my hero, that's my guy I'm going to rally behind. It's really just watching these players plopped into this mess where they've got to survive the bulldozer. And I actually really liked that. You were mentioning how it felt, the reality part of it. I felt that felt more real, you know, where you're not casting people into specific roles. You're casting people as real people who would be doing this job. And that was something that I thought was a little different about this. You don't see that very often. And it kept it, to me, pretty interesting all the way through.
Well, yeah, they oh, go ahead, Paul.
No, go.
I say, right, they make, he's not necessarily likable at first, because he's a little, they establish early that he's a little standoffish from the rest of the crew. And there's the one guy that's the, is it Neville Brand? Or anyway, the not Max, but it's the guy that gets run over at the end, goes to the beach. He's kind of,
I believe that's Neville Brand Chubb.
Is it? He's Neville Brand is Chubb. That's the mechanic, I think. Anyway.
Yeah.
He's the guy that's on the screen on my TV right now. He's kind of happy-go-lucky, and he's the one that kind of snaps. That he, after his friend Mac gets killed at the very beginning, he kind of loses it, and slowly, and one guy says he's coming off his spool. So you've got that guy who, and then you've got the bucket guy who's just as abrasive. He butts heads with Walker from the beginning, and he seems like he has throughout this whole process, this whole time they've been on the island. And that evolution is they slowly start to trust each other and kind of respect each other towards the end.
It's Dutch.
So, Dutch.
His character.
Yeah, Dutch is...
King's Wainwright.
He's the one... He's the kind of... He's the one that didn't seem like he's taking his job very seriously. He just kind of wants to play around when they were investigating that one thing.
Okay, just I want to try and get the character straight in my head. We have Neville Brand is Chubb Foster. We'll talk about him in a minute, but he's the mechanic. We have Carl Betts, who's basically kind of like the second in command. We have James Wainwright as Dutch, and he's the one that you were just talking mm-hmm. about. And then we have James Watson as Al Beltran, and he's the one who is kind of like he's the loose cannon who goes yep. in and starts up the bulldozer when he shouldn't. And then we have Robert Urich as Mac McCarthy, and I want to talk about him next, but let's finish your thought.
No, just saying that it does. He's neither one of them are traditional. I see Walker or both of them, and I like the guy that plays the bucket loader. He's I've seen him from before, but I just like his performance in this. But they're a lot like, think of about Roy Scheider and Jaws. Roy Scheider's not a hero. He's a guy that is just in a situation where he's trying to survive. And that's what these two guys are, just, here's our situation. We're not heroes. We're not trying to be heroes. We just want to live. We have to do what we have to do. So I think that makes them more real.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Now, I'm going to move on to Robert Urich. And Robert Urich, of all the people in this, is the one I'm most familiar with. But most, by far, of that familiarity is stuff that took place after this. At the point when he did this, I may be getting my years mixed up, so I'm not 100% sure. He may have done Magnum Force before this. And that would probably be the only thing I had ever seen him in before this. And his part is relatively small. You know, he's the first one, spoilers, everybody, he's the first one who gets killed off in the movie. And he gets killed off in a way where I think it keeps you believing that they're not blaming an anthropomorphized bulldozer right now, because it's not that the bulldozer attacks him and crushes him or anything like that. He just happens to be operating it he's not operating it. He's standing by it when it is contacted with this meteorite that that takes over it. And somehow in that transference, he's infected with something that kills him. So they don't know, you know, they really don't understand why he died. You know, there is nothing in particular. The only thing that they have from him is that there was a blue light that, you know, seemed to transfer itself to the bulldozer, which, you know, again, if we want to try and be somewhat realistic about that, that would be almost meaningless to you. You're not going to say, oh, yeah, that's what killed you, the blue light. You know what I mean?
Well, he almost looks burned, like he had
yes.
radiation burns or something, because they keep him in shadow when you see him in the tent, so you don't get a good look at him. And they blame him for being out of his head, for making those statements when he was dying. I think that helps. But yeah, I always took it as being the creature is radiation or some kind of energy, and that's what burned him, and that's what caused him to die.
This sequence is pretty critical. Because of the fact that it adds to the point of the blue light, and we're talking about special effects and things like that, and I'm not knocking the special effects, please don't get me wrong, but I actually admire the choices that they made. They used him as a great example of adding a sense of, this is something significant that's happened. With the way they kept him in the shadows, the way the things happened to him that were a little bit different than anything that we see from any of the others later on, his need to tell Kelly, like, there's something I need to talk to you about. You know, because that's the only other person that was there, you know, knowing that it added this sense of very early on, because they've got an economics of time with this that they've got to kind of fill in. And that added the sense of, well, something significant's happened here. Not just we all saw as the viewers the blue light and the transference and that type of thing. It just added more depth to something in a short period of time, which, you know, kicks us off to where later events lead. But it's funny, for him having such a smaller role in this, it really is the catalyst of this whole piece. His death sequence is really important.
Right, because it affects Dutch. Because him and Dutch were kind of buddies, and that kind of what starts Dutch kind of going, you know, off the rails. And it also what's his name? Carl Betts heard what he said to Clint Walker. So he questions him about it later. So he kind of, he's the one that kind of clues in that something's going on. He goes and gets parts of the meteor and brings it back to Walker and says, hey, you know, what does this look like to you? You know, and he goes, well, it could be possibly a meteor. So that's when I don't know if they ever established that something from outer space, but that's when Clint Walker starts to agree that, okay, maybe there is something here, and how do we fix it?
Defeat it. So, you know, right off the bat, they say, you know, there's something wrong here. Don't use this bulldozer. You hear me? Do not use this bulldozer. So what happens? Immediately somebody uses the bulldozer. and that just sets it off. If he had just left it alone, they could have lived. But then he's riding it. It's showing itself to be out of control. It's showing itself to have some form of motivation, whether, you know, my thoughts, if I'm on this thing, is that there's probably somebody with a remote control that's working it from afar or something. But what's the stupidest thing you could do that at that point? Let me jump off of it so that I'm an easy target for it, because while I'm on it, it can't really do anything to me. So he jumps off it, and that's that.
Well, and the second stupid thing he does, he crawls into a drainage pipe. I don't know how he thought that was going to save him.
That was another example of a horrific death that you don't, like, I'm a fan of that in the horror genre. You don't need to see everything. You don't need to, you know, we do the Hitchcock series on this as well. And he does a really good job of, you know, sometimes it's not about seeing the gore or that type of thing. The idea of the claustrophobia of he climbed into that thing, which we could really, you know, it's one of those things where we could take him aside and want to shake him afterwards as far as like, what were you thinking? Like, how is that going to protect you? But the idea that he was crushed into that was you didn't need to see like blood and guts and anything like that. The visual they left us with put a lot more in our head than we needed to see visually. I thought that I'm a fan of that in horror because of the fact that I do think your mind takes you way farther than anything they could possibly show you on screen. And that was a great sequence.
Well, I think Dutch's death is pretty graphic in that you don't see it, but you know what's going on because the bulldozer is approaching him at the end and he stalled his Jeep and he's drunk and you can see his face. As the bulldozer gets closer, you know, he could have jumped out and ran. The thing's only going about 3 miles an hour. But just before he hits him, he kind of, you see that look on his face where he just resolved himself. I'm done. And he closes his eyes. And then the bulldozer just kind of basically, it crushes him with its tracks. It just goes over there. It crushes the whole Jeep. So yeah, it's a lot of the deaths. Growing up, and I think this is when you misremember something, when the guy gets killed, Beltran gets killed in the pipe, I had a memory, and this is probably spread through talking about from people, kids at school and my brothers, that you could, after he's killed him, you could see his arm hanging off the bulldozer blade. That's not true, but we misremembered that. So we would talk about, oh, look, if you look, you can see his arm. It's on the blade.
So that's a Mandela effect?
Yep.
Interesting. I liked the casting of Neville Brand as the mechanic. He's another one that I'm familiar with from one appearance. Now, he's been in a ton of stuff, or he was in a ton of stuff, mostly Westerns, which if you watch him at all, he seems really suited for that. I know him from a movie from 1980 called The Ninth Configuration, which is based on a story called Twinkle, Twinkle, Killer Kane, written and directed by William Peter Blatty, who was the writer of The Exorcist. And it's a Stacy Keach movie, and it's very, very offbeat. And he has a fairly significant supporting role in that movie. So that he stood out, that I remember him from that. I just feel like he almost is cast so well that he doesn't call attention to himself. And I think it's almost silly, like, it feels like a contradiction in terms, but he just seems so fitting for the role that, like, you just roll with him. He doesn't, you know, you don't have to kind of stretch to figure him out or anything like that. He just, you know, he just feels very natural to me. And I, like I said, I just thought he was, you know, virtually perfect casting for this type of thing.
I'd agree. He does kind of disappear into the role.
And then we have Carl Betts as, as Dennis Hulvig. I know Carl Betts very vaguely because I've only seen a handful of episodes, but he played Donna Reed's husband on the Donna Reed Show, and that's what I remember him for. And I remember him being, again, I only remember him vaguely, but I remember him being very, very white bread, you know, a really, you know, just kind of somebody who was there because somebody had to play her husband. Not that he was particularly significant in any way. And in this, he shows a little bit more edginess, which I like. He's not really the most likable character, but he is kind of on point in what he's saying and doing. And he is, you know, one of two people who survived this at the end. So I liked his role in it as well.
Yeah, I liked him. Oh, go ahead, Sean.
One of the things I really liked about this cast and how they actually handled them was as they paired back, as people, as deaths happened, they had interesting configurations. I thought he was great casting because he's one of the people that I think that gets more and more interesting as the film goes on, because of the fact that there's these relationships that are friction-based that are there. These are guys that, especially as you pair back, there's less and less people who actually liked each other at the start of this that are surviving together. I mean, their relationships are ones of we work together, but we're not necessarily pals or buddies. Even they even throw like a little gasoline on the fire with each other at certain points in time. You know, like Kelly's, the fact that Kelly had alcoholism at a certain point in time. And Carl Betts' characters, you know, like sitting here, you know, it's okay to have a drink and that type of thing. Knowing the way that that played out, knowing the fact that he knew that that was a thing and did it anyway, it says a lot about his character just being, having an element of him. He's a jerk. I mean, it's considering the situation that everyone's going through. And I like the fact that these were some layered characters. I thought he played a great role in this in the sense that he was very much a three-dimensional character that was not wooden. And there were things I really liked about him as the film went on, but there were also things where I'm like, he's a jerk. And I think that's, those are certain interactions when you get with people, you know, that you have to learn how to get to know all of the layers of them to build relationships. And these are people that, due to circumstance, the last three survivors, you could make strong arguments that I don't know. I guess maybe you would say that Carl's character and James's characters, you know, are a little bit more friendly out of the batch. But certainly both of them have friction-based relationships with Kelly. And these are guys who've got to band together to try and overcome this at the end. And I really liked that. It added another whole sense of danger to this whole thing. But Betts played a great role. Great role with this.
Yeah. Well, it starts out with it's all of the guys versus Walker, because he's kind of driving them to get work, and he's seems to be kind of, you know, he has his past that I guess not all of them are aware of. And then as the killdozer, as the dozer comes in, then they have to work, to your point, Sean, they have to work together, even though they don't like him. And there's even a scene where after the dozer has destroyed the camp and they're kind of picking up all the pieces they can, and salvaging everything, Dutch starts to get in the Jeep with Walker, looks at him, and then goes and gets in there with Neville Brand. So he's like, still at that point, doesn't trust Walker. It's a little like they didn't quite establish it, but, you know, there is the movie trope of you've got a group of people in a remote situation, and usually they are all there because they screwed up, or this is their last chance. I'm thinking, like, if you've ever seen the movie Wages of Fear or the remake Sorcerer, where these guys are all in, they're in South America somewhere, because they screwed up something in their life, and they're at the end of their line. So they're all kind of brought together, and then they have to work together, kind of like the Dirty Dozen. You know, those guys have all been, you know, were in jail, and they give him one last chance to make amends. Now, this is not quite the same. It's more Clint Walker's character that he's dying to fix his career. But it's that where you get that initial confrontation, and then they all have to learn to work together.
Any more comments about the casting? Because my notes are pretty much exhausted.
Dutch I really liked as a character because it was interesting. He was very, very focused on his lost friend very early on, you know, mm-hmm. and it becomes a reoccurring theme, you know, because he'll reference the, you know, things that they could have done, and the swimming thing keeps coming up over and over again. But he has the moment with Chubb where, you know, he tells him to jump, and he jumps to save himself, you know, when their plan goes awry because the bulldozer was smarter than them, which was intriguing. But I liked that they played off of the guilt piece, you know, through the dialogue and interactions between, because he was the survivor of that, whereas Chubb was not. And he has that moment where the bulldozer's pushing the rocks over the edge, and he actually is the one that saves all of them. By making the decision at that point in time, he could have driven off in the Jeep. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, there's zero reason why he couldn't. And I liked his arc, where we got to see this character at least have some evolution, where he had to make the choice again, and made the choice to take the risk to save them. Because now he's driving a Jeep into the rocks, not knowing what that's going to be. And I mean, it was an interesting sort of sequence where you've got this bulldozer pushing these rocks over the edge, but from the height they were falling from, they're going to cause some damage. And I really liked that he had like a heroic arc. There was, again, the economics of time. They had a short period of time here. They gave some interesting arcs for these characters that I thought was something that was a lot of fun in this. And Dutch was one of those characters that he goes from being one thing to becoming a little bit more intriguing as the whole story goes along. I liked him having that moment, even though he's still broken by everything that's happened around him. And it made his death more powerful for me because of the fact that because of his heroic save, I liked him more. And then you put him in this situation where now he's still suffering because of everything that's going on around him. And it just made his death one of those tragedies where you're like sitting here like, oh, man, I like that guy.
He does try to. His death seems a little more tragic than the rest. But just because you point, he is broken. And I think in the short story and in the comic, there's a character that kind of snaps and is actually trying to feed victims to the bulldozer. It kind of starts working with the bulldozer because he doesn't want to die. Hmm. So I wonder if he's kind of loosely based on that because he does. He seems to be the happiest there. He seems to be just enjoying. He's getting a kick out of in that Quonset hut at the very beginning, and then he's picking out all the old stuff and he's trying to get Robert Guerick interested in it. And Yarbrick didn't care, but he seems to be, and that's when when Yurik dies, he's most affected by it, that they have some kind of history together, because he does mention they used to go swimming together on the beach, so those two must have come to the island as a pair. The rest seem to be individuals, except for Walker and Chubb seems like they've got a relationship, because he talks about having previous equipment that would go crazy. So
now, this was directed by Jerry London, and this was the first movie in his filmography. So, you know, he has a reasonably long filmography, most of which seems to be filled with TV productions, whether movies or TV episodes. There are a few that seem to be actual theatrical releases, but for the most part, it seems like they were TV movies. I would say he's most famous for having done the TV miniseries Shogun back in 1980. Oh. But you know, this was his first directorial effort. I thought he did a workmanlike job on this. I don't think there's anything about it that stands out as particularly artistic. I don't think it has the, you know, rising above the material that Steven Spielberg did with Duel. But I think he works well with the material he had, if that makes sense. I don't think, you know, in a less skilled set of hands, this could have come off as extremely campy. And I don't think it did. I think he managed to keep a relatively serious tone to it without letting it become boring. Now, part of that is due to the fact that it's only a 74-minute movie. But, you know, it could have easily been more forgettable, and it could have easily been campy, and it could have easily been boring. And it was none of those three. So I give him credit for doing a good job with it.
I'd agree. I think most of the shots are by the numbers. He keeps the cast in line where they produce a strong performance without going way over top, because they could have had, like Dutch, just go really crazy and chew the scenery, and that doesn't happen. Or they could have been much more conflict with it. So I think you're right. There's nothing stands out special at it, but it's he gets the job done for what he needs to do.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Tim, the music score. I thought, and I think you're going to disagree with me, I thought it was pretty much, again, by the numbers. I thought, you know, when it was supposed to be a science fiction thing, they added kind of a science fiction-y type music to it. I didn't think there was anything about it that really stood out to me. I didn't think it was bad, but it didn't stand out to me as particularly strong either. So I think you may have a better opinion of it than that.
Well, when I say music, I guess I'm talking about the more the synthesized used and tones they've used to create the sound of Killdozer. The background music is, I didn't really notice it. I just thought that, and I'm gonna be cloud my judgment a little bit, because I'm just a big fan of it. Night Olshak. And he did the theme for that. But, it's like the music in Jaws, that they create that kind of humming, buzzing sound that designates that's the Killdozer. And especially when his eyes are, you know, they do that with the lights will get bright to show it's looking at something.
I almost threw up in my mouth when you said that this is like Jaws.
Well, I mean, they have the same effect, not the same quality, the same effect. There's a sound that designates when Killdozer is around, as opposed to this sound with Jaws. Yeah, I'll let you get that one. I'm not doing that.
There's really two separate lanes in this. There is a use of sound, and there is music. I agree with you, Paul, as far as the music itself in the background being kind of a paint-by-numbers kind of piece off of that. Not bad. It's a decent enough musical score. But it's not one of those things where I'm sitting there like, I'm not humming any tunes from this. But the use of sound is something I do think that they use that as a clever tool in this. Giving this sense of life to the bulldozer. That's where they did use music, I think, to give it kind of that kind of theme for when that alien thing is coming at you. I thought that was effective. But I also think, and it was something I said earlier, I think the choice of when not to use sound was also really effective, because you've got to make me believe that a bulldozer can sneak up on these people. And because to the point of earlier discussion from both of you, it's a bulldozer. It's going to be making a lot of noise. They did a really good job of pairing back sound at the right times, because you hear that thing lumbering around, you're lost in this. You're not going to feel like in that moment the suspension of disbelief that's necessary is there. So their choice of when to use that musicality of the bulldozer, the alien bulldozer coming at you, and those special effects, and also quiet I think was something that really worked for me here, but there's nothing I was humming from this other than the fact if I hear that sound of that alien bulldozer, I'm running for the hills.
Any more thoughts on this before we come up with the final rating?
It's enjoyable. It was fun to watch, and it buzzes by. I mean, it's quick.
I would also mention that I mentioned the Tuesday and Wednesday movies of the week earlier. While we were talking, I posted a picture of the TV Guide ad for the movie on the Is It Jaws Facebook page, and it mentions that it's the ABC Saturday suspense movie. So this was not a Tuesday or Wednesday movie of the week. But I think it's time to rate it. So, you know, Tim, I'm going to let you go first on this one.
Okay.
I think you have the highest level of fondness for this.
If we can do partials, I'm going to give it a low Jaws 2. Because it's not... It could have been, your point, Sean, it could have been really campy and over the top and overdone. And they worked well with what they had, so it's not near Jaws at all. But I'll give it like a Jaws 2-. We can do that.
Yeah, well, you can make it a low Jaws 2. You can make it a high Jaws 3. You can make it whatever you want.
Yeah,
that's the beauty of this show. I get to run.
High Jaws 3, but my fondness for it is going to give it a low Jaws 2.
Okay, Sean, what do you think?
Actually, we're in the same place. My first viewing through, I was high Jaws 3. And I didn't, you know, I don't have the nostalgia for it and those type of pieces. Where that changed for me in my second viewing was the fact that if I was going to point somebody to a movie and say, boy, TV movies were really an important part of, just the 70s and just kind of the way we were interacting with television and media. And, you know, there's some decent ones out there that really are worth watching, you know, and make a good use of the time. And this didn't have any wasted moments. There wasn't any fluff in this. I thought it was a good story. I enjoyed watching it the second time. And it was, you know, a compressed time between viewings. I didn't feel like, oh my God, this is a root canal watching this again. I really enjoyed it the second time. I give it a low Jaws too, because I'd recommend it. And I would say that this is something that, hey, TV, I would start with a caveat. This was a TV movie. But in 2024, I watched it and I wasn't saying, man, the special effects are just like not there and I really needed to step aside. I think it holds up, you know, as far as in quality of what was being done there. And it's a really good suspense horror kind of movie. You can see how this type of movie had an influence on a lot of horror movies that came afterwards, including things like your Friday the 13th and, you know, take the bulldozer out of it. Put Jason in there, put Michael Myers in there, put Freddy Krueger in there. And there's some elements of this that very much work in those movies as well. So you can see how this is that kind of storytelling, and it worked really well. And, yeah, so I'd definitely say Low Jaws too, because I'd recommend it.
We're basically the same place. I call it a high Jaws 3, not a low Jaws 2. But, I mean, they're kind of there's a little bit of a Venn diagram going there. I am somewhat nostalgia-driven on this. From a nostalgia point of view, I might just give it a Jaws 2 because, you know, I could sit and watch this multiple times, and it's fine. It's trim. It's only 74 minutes. It's easy to watch. If it was on, I agree with you guys. I'd say, you know, if you have an eye for movies of this ilk, that this, I would recommend this for that reason. I think the performances are all pretty good. I think that the direction is, you know, very capable. And the story is kind of fun, and it's in a non-campy way. I'm pretty comfortable with it being a high Jaws 3. And I enjoyed taking a look at it. And if you enjoyed hearing this, again, on the next Back to the Bins, the three of us are going to come back and we're going to take a look at Worlds Unknown number 6 and do a deep dive into that one, which is another adaptation. And we'll, I'm sure we'll have a discussion as to whether it's an adaptation of the book or the film, and some thoughts like that about it. So hopefully you can check in with us then and listen to that as well. But in the meanwhile, other than being a guest on this show every once in a while, Tim, where can everybody find you?
I'm on the Two True Freaks Network as well. I'm Third Degree Burn with Brian Hughes and Kurt Greenfield, and we've added Nigel Spink. Dave Thompson joins us occasionally, John Hyatt. So we joke that most of our people that write in, we just invite in the show. And we cover John Byrne. So we are in the middle of right now finishing up our West Coast Avengers run, and then we're going to get into I don't know. I think we're going to talk about doing Alpha Flight maybe next. We've been doing those kind of as index shows. So if you like John Byrne or discussions, and Brian and I have been started doing the commentaries on the new X-Men 97 cartoon that's on Disney Plus. We've got 2 episodes out now, and we're going to cover the rest of those.
Yeah, it's a cool conversational level show, and sometimes what is the drinks and whatever episodes?
We do, cocktails and comics. That can be not burn related. That can be whatever we want it to be. We do those whenever the mood hits us. That's usually.
I enjoy listening to it, and every once in a while I'll hear on the show, "Oh, Paul Spataro said this," and I, you know, it just makes me feel good inside. Thanks for coming on, Tim, and thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Let's get out of here!